Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Alchemy Lab with Colm Holland. And I'm Colm Holland, author of The Secret of the Alchemist. And welcome to another exciting session in this series of fortnightly podcasts, where I have amazing conversations with real live alchemists. And we discuss things on sensational topics. For example, today we'll be talking a little bit how to create a potion for the secret of happiness, amongst other things. And it is today my complete honor to introduce my alchemist guest in the Alchemy Lab, the wonderful Emma Disney. Hi, Emma.
Good morning, and thank you so much for inviting me into your lab.
No, the pleasure is, seriously, the pleasure is all ours. Of course, just for the sake benefit of everybody, this is a virtual Alchemy Lab. We are keeping social distancing today. In fact, what are we, about 100 miles away from each other?
At least, I believe, yes.
You're in Brighton, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Okay. Have you always lived in Brighton? Is that, or did you move there recently? What?
No, I moved to Brighton to go to university 25 years ago.
Okay.
And then worked in London for about 10 years and then came back down to Brighton to have my kids 18 years ago. So it's been a place I've based myself on and off for a while.
Okay, people who live outside of the UK, Brighton is probably one of the few places that the name they'll recognise. While we're in this virtual lab, please ignore if you hear any bubbling potions going on or strange scents emanating from test tubes. So, it's just ignore it. It's just my lab experiments. I've always got some kind of secret experiment and mixture on the boil. So
it's the magic happening by the sound of it.
Always, Emma. Thank you. Yes. So we'd love to know a little bit more about you. I know that you're a qualified counsellor, a hypnotherapist, and quite frankly, all-round wonderful person. Do you want to just tell us a little bit more about your professional life?
I'm a psychotherapist. I work with a range of people, but I specialise in working with teenagers and their mental and emotional well-being. I've done it for about 20 years, and I'm passionate about mental health. I believe that mental health is so underspoken about and undervalued, and there are a lot of kids nowadays having huge issues with how their head works because of how we are living. So I work, 80% of my clients are teenagers, 20% are adults, and it's a real luxury for people to sit and to feel safe and to share how they're feeling and what they're going through. And together we find a way through the trauma or the heartache or the pain, so they can find some clarity and a route back to calm.
Right. So you say you specialise in teenage mental health. Is there a reason for that? Did that happen by accident, or was it a choice that you made at some point?
It was something I always wanted to do. My teenage years were incredibly challenging, and I had a couple of things that happened to me that made me feel unstable, that impacted my mental health. And I didn't really have anyone to talk to. So I became a bit of a bookworm and started exploring the understanding of trauma and chaos through reading. And I always knew from being a teenager that I wanted to be able to offer what I didn't have. So I had a career in London doing something completely different and then retrained 20 years ago. And I'm now living my dream by working with teenagers and kind of providing a bit of an anchor when they're going through rough times, coming to therapy, sharing how they feel, and also working with them and their parents to make life feel calm. Because I believe the teenage years are a huge transition, and the transformation can be incredible if they feel supported and heard and have all their needs met. So it was a choice, yes.
So do you think everybody that when we go through adolescence, is it just a biological, is it a chemical, is it just a normal experience to experience some weird and wonderful feelings, sometimes tragic, sometimes not? From your studies, what are your thoughts on that? Is there any way of avoiding it, or is it just part of growing up?
I think it's part of it is growing up. Neurologically, the brain in the teenage years is going through the most incredible growth. So if you base everything just from a biological point of view, your brain in your teenage years is both growing and being pruned. So it's a bit like imagining a snow globe, and that snow globe is being shaken every single minute. And then at that point, we're asking our teenagers to study hard, to do exams, to understand who they are, to know what they want to do. And I think nowadays with social media, which can be amazing and also it can be quite destructive, we're then saying to our teen, don't forget you've got to fit in or get better grades or do more sport or achieve more. So I think there's a lot of pressure on teenagers to be whatever they don't even know they want to be at that point. So I think everyone goes through the transition. I believe and I feel if we as parents can support them to get whatever it is they need, whether it's calm time, whether it's sleep, whether it's understanding, whether it is allowing them to rebel a little, they can find and create their own anchor and become more resilient. But unfortunately, in today's world, there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of worst case thinking. So a lot of kids grow up believing that life is difficult, that dreams don't get reached. And I believe it puts even more pressure on the way they think, and the way they think impacts the way they feel. So I think the teenage years can be an incredible time of growth if that teenager has some of their basic needs met.
Yeah, I've heard you say once that without mental health, there is no health.
Oh, for me, having a massive passion for the importance of mental health, if we're not thinking right, it doesn't matter what is happening in our life. It doesn't matter how wealthy, it doesn't matter how loved, it doesn't matter how anything we are. If our head isn't calm and we can't think right, then nothing feels okay. And I work with people who struggle with severe anxiety, depression, bipolar, borderline personality disorder, even just everyday stress. And we know that when we're feeling any of those things, stress, anxiety, worry, we don't think well. So without mental health, there is no health, because we're not feeling okay being who we are.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, Emma.
Please do.
Feel free to say no. You said that you went through some experiences in your own teenage life, and that has inspired you towards your professional work and helping others, which is amazing. Thank you for on behalf of everybody that you do that. Can you just talk? Do you feel able just to talk a little bit more in detail about what you went through and how you resolved your own challenges?
With pleasure. I had someone attacked me in quite a brutal way when I was 15, and I didn't share it with anyone because I didn't feel safe to share it with anyone, which led to me being quite withdrawn. It also led to me having an eating disorder. So from about 15 and a half for a few years, I chose to control my emotions by not eating, which kind of took over my life. I still managed to do school and college and go to uni, but it threw me off track. So I started to destroy how I could have been me by believing that it was my fault. I also had a challenging childhood in how I grew up, so I didn't feel safe to share how I felt with anyone that was in my vicinity. So I learned to read books. I learned to watch programs. I think Oprah Winfrey for me at one point was really good, because she talked about we can either choose to be a victim or we can choose to rise and make our life what we want.
Yeah.
And I think for me, every time something happened that felt destructive, I learned to look within and understand how I could make it work for me. So my teenage years were destructive, painful. I felt very much alone. I felt disconnected. I didn't feel like a turn to my family. So I navigated them as best I could with the teenage brain, which wasn't always that well. And I think that's led me to want to explore and be curious as to how we can all grow through some really traumatic, painful times, because we can. I don't believe things happen for a reason, but I do believe we can find a reason within the things that happen to us. They can transform us if we choose to let them.
Okay, I'll come back to formation, which you just mentioned there. But I just wonder, was there a point then towards the end of adolescence or in young adulthood where you felt you'd sort of come out of the tunnel?
I think, and I'll be really, really honest with you, reading was my escape. Reading, intellectualizing whatever had happened to me, allowed me to understand it. I don't believe I started to process my feelings. I think I just learned to understand this is what some people do and this is what I need to do. And, which I think is very relevant because as the author of The Secret of The Alchemist came out by Paulo Coelho when I was in my early 20s. And I do remember reading that and thinking, okay, well then life is a journey and I can learn to acknowledge that all of this that has gone on for me is only going to make me stronger. So I think for me, the tunnel is something I probably go through regularly-ish every few years, because as we go through, we grow through stuff. So yeah. I think I came out at some point only to venture back in at another point.
So the novel, The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, which I was really fortunate to be involved in the publication of that, as you know from my story in The Secret of the Alchemist. But that story then was that sort of like the alchemist, quote unquote, in your life? Was that a moment where you felt, okay, somebody gets this? I know I don't feel so alone. Was that the experience of that book?
Oh, most definitely. When I read that book, well, I bought hundreds of copies of that for all of my kids' friends and also for all of my friends, because right. I think if we can understand that life is a journey, there is no destination. It's a constant journey. Yeah. And it's for us to explore that. So for me, yeah, The Alchemist was a massive turning point, and I always feel very grateful to him and for you for bringing the book forward, because I don't know where I'd be if I hadn't have read that and one or two other books at that point in my life.
Okay, I'm sure the universe, the love would have found some other way, Emma, because you have one of the secret ingredients. And one of the things when I talk about The Secret of the Alchemist in his novel, one of the things that's pretty obvious is that without that commitment, that passion, against all the doubts and the fears that would stop us moving forward, without that, then the ability to find our treasure, to realize our dreams, is probably pretty slim. And I talk in my book about the various stages that I believe we do need to go through, things that we need to look out for, and the things that we need to activate in ourselves. We can do that. Emma, fascinating. You've written a book, I understand. Is that right?
It certainly is. Very exciting for me.
It's got an interesting title. It's called Teen Pause. That's TEEN-A-Pause. I'm sure it's got a double meaning. Explain the double meaning, if you will.
It has. It's a book about, from parenting point of view, how to parent your teens. And the most important part of it is about we as parents have to take a pause when we're dealing with teenagers, because teenagers are working from the most emotional part of their brain. So they can overreact. They can be incredibly challenging on occasions. And if we meet them where they are, it can turn into huge conflict. Whereas if we pause and we stop and we look at what's happening for us, we can choose to be aware of our wounds, our emotional baggage, our pain, and we can heal ourselves at the same time as supporting our teen to become their best selves.
Okay. So let's just pause there for a second. So the pause that you're talking about applies to the parents of teenagers. Is that the demographic of the book?
That's exactly it, yes.
Okay. Sorry, I think in my mind I was thinking it was something that teenagers would it be of any help to intelligent teenagers to read as well?
Do you think? Well, to be fair, my son read through the book recently and said that he took a lot from it to understand how it is to be a teenager, the parents' perspective, and how some of the reactions that parents and teens have are weighted either way, the parents or the teen. And he said he enjoyed, I put questions throughout the chapters to get people to reflect on how they are, who they are.
Right.
And he said him and his girlfriend loved answering the questions. So
have you got the book there? Have you got any of the questions?
So I've got one of the, with the emotional wealth, I've got questions. So this says, take time to explore. When someone ignores me, I feel. When someone cries, I feel. When someone praises me, I feel. And I've got about 25 different statements. And what I'm asking the parent to do, and they can ask the child too, is to explore how they feel when different situations occur,
right,
so they can become aware of their feelings in those moments.
So once you become aware of the feelings, what do you do with that awareness?
Well, what a lot of people don't do is they're not aware of it, so they react. When you have an awareness of your feelings, then you have the power to choose. So if I'm aware that one of my teens has been short or rude to me and I feel upset, I either react back and I get upset with them, or I take a pause and I ask them why they're speaking like that. I ask if they want to talk about it, or I can walk away and say, let's talk about this later when you feel in a different mood. So it stops the conflict that lots of parents and teens have by reacting as opposed to responding.
Okay. We haven't had this, we haven't talked, had this bit of the conversation before, but I'm going to throw it in.
Please do.
Tell me, so not a lot of people know this, but I actually used to be a high school teacher. When I left university, that was my first career. So you can imagine, as a teacher in a classroom situation, when you're surrounded by 20 adolescents.
Yeah, all, I can't imagine, but yeah.
all feeling different things, and none of the training that you did as a teacher in university, doing your degree in education, prepared you for how you might respond to that. And it was quite obvious. It became pretty clear to me. And if people think back to their own school experience of high school and the teachers who influenced them, who they felt were a positive force in life, that the teachers who were able to manage their own responses.
Oh, so true.
Yeah, were the ones who you didn't misbehave with. They were the ones who you respected. They were the ones who you cooperated with, and other staff would quite often, and I would see other staff who were good at this, and I reflected back on, I had fortunately I had a couple of really good teachers in my own upbringing who I emulated. So I, even though I wasn't trained, I just sort of copied how I'd seen them manage a class, and that kind of got me through. That was my experience in that situation. But one of the key things that came out of my role as a teacher was the power of the peer group.
Mm.
If there is a moment, I think, in our lives when the peer group, the tribalness of the peer group applies its most pressure, it's probably in adolescence.
I completely agree with you.
So what, as a parent then, when you know that a teenager being sort of sucked in or taken in or is not really following their own, being their own true self, they're succumbing to the peer group identity. Have you got any advice for to how to navigate out of that?
For me, the parents that I've watched navigate that well, and with my teenagers, if you're a place as their parent where they feel safe to talk and they choose to bring their concerns or they tell you what's happening within their peer group, if they can use you to talk through things, I have found with both the kids that come to me as my clients in therapy and my own children, when they can talk it through, then kids can find the resilience or the power to listen to themselves, to find a way through that without reacting too dramatically. I've had some kids that have found themselves in the middle of groups of friends who are taking lots of drugs or really misbehaving, acting out. And when they talk to me and we talk through it, or if they talk to their parents and then come to therapy, or my kids talk to me, and someone lays out the truth for them, not emotionally, but just the truth of the situation. So if you do A, B, C, this is what might happen, or you could do E, F, G, and this might happen. You give the kids the choice to empower themselves. All of our kids, all of the teenagers will have friends that do things that are above the law, or that are naughty, or that could get them into trouble. It's teaching our kids to be resilient enough to trust themselves, and to have the support to be able to be brave enough to say no when they're being led astray or feel the pressure to do stuff they don't want to do.
Okay. This podcast is going around the world. It's a global podcast, okay, Emma? There'll be more than people living in Britain. And we know that different cultures have different parenting styles.
Yeah.
And even within different cultures, there are different groups who believe that parenting should be in another way. One of two of the opposing positions traditionally, from what I know and have read over the years, on the one hand, it's what the Bible used to call, you know, spare the rod and spare the child, you know, spoil the child. In other words, discipline is the only real way to control this minefield that is adolescence. And on the other hand, of course, from the 1950s, 60s, the opposite, which is you shouldn't interfere, just leave them to it. They'll find their own way. They'll navigate their own way through it. And if they come out of it, okay, fine. If they don't, well, just too bad. But you should just not get involved. It sounds as though modern psychological thinking and therapy has moved on, from those two extremes, would you say?
I completely agree. I think what's happened for me as a parent and as a therapist is a balance in between. So discipline and boundaries are vital. You need to know what it is you believe in to be right or wrong or healthy or unhealthy, and then share that with your kids. So my kids know that good behavior gets rewarded, and they get to do the things they want to do with their friends, and they get to watch screens, and they get to have fun. And if they behave in a way that isn't appropriate with what I believe is appropriate in our house, there will be consequences. So I don't believe that it is child-centric. I believe every family has values that are important to them. And then it's teaching our children how best to live within the values. I think the confusing bit at the moment, bringing up children at this point, is a lot of parents don't always want to upset their children or disappoint their children. So a lot of helicopter parenting or doing what the kids want, which isn't always what's best for the kids in the long term. So I believe in discipline and I believe in boundaries, but I also believe in communication. I believe in the power of connection, and I believe in being authentic to show your child you can role model what they need to be who they are.
Okay, here's a curveball.
I love these.
So I'm a teenager.
Yep.
And I'm actually the most emotionally intelligent person in my family.
Yep.
My parents didn't get the help they needed. They spawned me, and what I've discovered is actually I probably know more than they do. So here am I, a teenager, knowing, I mean, these parents are not going to be the parents who read your book, but some people listening to this podcast may well be teenagers who find themselves in that totally chaotic family environment where they're struggling with their own stuff, but also coping with dysfunctional parenting going on, especially if they see that happening to their siblings who are struggling. What if you I'm sure you come across many of these in your work, but what advice can you give to teenagers who are probably the most responsible person in their family?
I would say to learn and accept that you are the most responsible in your family. Yeah. And if possible, find ways to communicate, whether that is writing in a journal, whether that is drawing pictures, whether that's playing in a band, whether that's listening to music or reading books. Find your journey and know that your parents perhaps are not doing it to you because of you. Mm-hmm. This is their stuff.
Yeah.
And recognize that this part of the journey might be the hardest part of your life journey. So I'd find support. And it might not even be people. It might be music or art. It might even be, I'm not saying it's okay, but some kids fall off the track and have the wrong peers, but it's their peers that keep them going. So it's finding ways to support yourself that feels safe enough to grow through. Lots of kids have very difficult teenage years, and it's getting through that as best you can whilst learning about yourself and knowing this part of the journey might actually shape, this might be the biggest storm that shapes you to get to where you need to get to. So create dreams, start to dream beyond your teenage years and start to believe in those dreams, even if they feel impossible. So it's that anchoring within yourself whilst recognizing your resilience. For me, it was books and writing a journal. For other people, I know it's music or playing an instrument or being part of a sports team. There are so many ways to connect to the part of yourself that can teach you you're enough to stay safe and to know you can get through this.
Yes. For anybody who hasn't ever looked at some of the experiences that you mentioned, Oprah Winfrey, earlier, Emma. I am aware that Oprah has been pretty open about her own experiences through childhood, the abuse that she suffered, some of the horrendous things. And she talks very eloquently about finding that inner space within our own souls, as it were. It's that place that can never be touched.
Yeah, I agree. It's part of your heart.
Yeah.
But you have to have the belief within that, because if you've been so broken by the people around you,
yeah,
that can be a difficult place to connect to. So if you can't connect to that, it's connecting to someone that can take you there, some book, some music, some song. It's finding a way back to yourself when the people around you aren't reflecting who you are.
Yeah. In my book, The Secret of the Alchemist, I spend a lot of time throughout the book reminding us all, teenager, adult, whoever we are, that the universe and our lives are infused with what I call unconditional love.
I completely agree.
There is a power, there is a force, there is, and if when we feel bombarded with negativity and pain and abuse around us, in my experience, there is a place we can go where it is only inhabited by unconditional love. And that is one of the unique things about being a human being, is that we have that. In my thinking, that's the treasure, that's the goal, that's the home of our dreams, and we can go there, we can find that place. And if you, as you say, if we need help with that, if we're going to try and get help with anything in our life, then that's one of the key things we should always try and get the help with.
Yeah, that makes so much sense.
Transformation, because finding that place, finding that safe haven within that is enveloped in love, does require what you and I referred to earlier as transformation.
Most so definitely.
Was there a moment in your life, because we're in the Alchemy Lab, transformation is the process that we're going through in the lab. Was there a moment in your life, one moment in particular, that you knew a moment of transformation had taken place?
There was one incredibly powerful and heartbreaking moment for me, and it was the moment I lost my first son. Josh was stillborn a few weeks before his due date. Oh, so and so the so moment so. I had to bury this little white coffin. I saw it going into the ground. I knew that it couldn't break me, and I knew that I had to take something from this, and I had to change in order that, even though he didn't live, that my life changed. And at that moment, that part you talk about, the unconditional love, even though my heart was broken, I knew I had to find something within me in order for me to grow from this, because I was so scared, I think the word was, that if I didn't grow, it would break me. And for me, that was when I retrained. I became a Samaritan, and then I retrained as a psychotherapist. So for me, he's been my guiding angel, or my star, my unconditional love, that has allowed me to navigate from my head, which is where I lived up until then, into my heart. So the power of unconditional acceptance and love and understanding, and not just understanding, but accepting. He was my transformation. I allowed the trauma of loss to become a moment of clarity and transformation.
The Alchemists, bless your heart, by the way.
Thank you.
Everybody listening to this is sending out their love and compassion to you right now. And probably everything you've just said is resonating with many people. Mm. Thank you for making yourself so vulnerable. The Alchemists used a metaphor for their inner transformation. The ancient alchemists who were writing on this very subject 3,000, 4,000 years ago, if not more. And one of the things one of the metaphors they used is the transformation of lead into gold. And of course, that metaphor was a metaphor for taking the weakness of our own beings, the bits of ourselves when they're at their most vulnerable, and allowing the secret ingredient of unconditional love into that place transforms, as was your experience, that weakness into our greatest strength. And I talk a lot in my book about true empowerment. And just say a little bit about, if you wouldn't mind, about what true empowerment looks like in your life, day to day, off the back of that incredibly traumatic experience. You've said a bit, but do you genuinely feel that you have a newfound power as a result of that you didn't have before?
Oh my goodness, there's no question about that. Before I lost my boy, I was very head-led, and life was a list of goals and ambitions, and it was a to-do list that I was very happy to tick off and move along. But I felt so very little. I'd taught myself to get through life and to learn, and I was curious about understanding, but I don't think I'd ever felt to the point where it was safe to feel even the heartbreak. So for me, that moment allowed me an insight into being empowered by my feelings, which up until then, like lots of children and teenagers, I hadn't been taught to feel. I hadn't been taught it was okay or it was safe to be a feeling, empathetic person. That wasn't safe growing up. So the moment, and I know it feels quite bizarre to say it, the moment I lost my son, I felt like he gave me my heart. He cracked it wide open for me to look at, and I truly started living from a place of feelings, which can be stormy and it can be rough some days, and on other days it can be the most blissful, joyful, happy experience ever, because whether it's walking by the sea and hearing the waves, or on other times watching someone struggle and feeling their pain, it taught me to be empowered by my feelings. It taught me to live both in my head and my heart, but in a balance that I strive for and work with every day where possible.
Okay, that's wonderful. And it's certainly our hope that everybody listening will take some comfort from what you've shared there, and that if they are experiencing a broken heart or a place of exposed pain, that they will find that way of opening themselves to love and allow that to heal and move them on. Now, you might have heard some strange noises going on, everybody, in this in this podcast. It's not the notifications on Emma's computer. it's
magic.
I know, it's magic. Well, what it is actually, it's I've got something bubbling away, because I mentioned earlier I'm actually cooking an experiment up at the moment, and it's I'm trying to get this potion called The Secret of Happiness. If I can bottle it, I'll put a label on it and I'll sell it globally and I'll become a multimillionaire. But in the meantime, do you want to, I need a bit of help, Emma, please. I think I've got some of the ingredients. So following your passion, I've got some of that.
I love that.
In there. Bliss, I found some little tincture of bliss the other day in a green bottle, which so I tipped a little bit, and that seems to get things bubbling quite well. So my levels of happiness are already increasing. But have you got any ingredients that you'd like to suggest we should put in this potion?
Well, for me, and I hope it works for others, being okay with who you are and where you are, even when it doesn't feel okay, because if you can be okay with where you are and hold on to your dreams, life does start to feel okay. So that would be one for me.
Okay.
Having at least one person that you can turn to and share how you are, who you are with, and they see you and they get you and they reflect back to you. And it might not even be a person. For some people, it might be an animal. But I think having someone in your life that accepts you for who you are, that makes me happy. So I imagine it would probably make other people happy.
Okay, tick. I've got those two.
Love and loving, feeling loved is always a precious moment when we recognize that. And also loving people, actually really connecting, whether it's a friend, whether it's a partner, whether it's a child, that feeling of love, when we actually stand in it and recognize it, is so, creates so much happiness. Maybe another ingredient?
Yeah, no, that's great. I actually, I'd forgotten about that. At the very beginning of my book, The Secret of the Alchemist, I actually put a quote of something that I discovered years ago, and it is that the greatest challenge we face, I believe, at the very core of our heart is to know that we are loved unconditionally, just for who we are.
Yeah.
Not for what we can do for somebody else. And I do hear and see a lot of people. And it's true, we do get a degree of happiness about by not being so focused on ourselves and being focused on other people's happiness. That's fine, but not if it's a substitute for not knowing that we're loved ourselves.
I agree, and I think the journey to loving ourselves is part of what can take us through the difficult times and the dark nights. So very much an important part of happiness.
All right, so love, got tick, got that. Anything else?
The one that I have found that's helped me with happiness is being present, because I think with the world being so busy and social media and everything else, I think we can have a head that's in yesterday and in tomorrow and what should be happening. But when I'm present and I'm fully in the moment, whether it's sitting talking to you now, which is a luxury, or sitting in the garden or walking by the sea, when I am present, then everything feels good. I'm engaged in life, and that feels very powerful. So being present would be another ingredient for me.
Okay, is that it? Am I missing?
There's just one more. There's just one magical more, and that is setting intentions. So when we have our dreams, when we set intentions to reach our dreams, for me, that allows me to be connected to believing in myself and loving myself enough to create dreams that make me feel happy.
Wonderful. We're nearly out of time, Emma. My goodness, how time flies when we get taken up in such deep and such valuable thoughts that we have with you today. Thank you so much for those.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's such a luxury.
I've I want to make, I've set aside a little bit of time before we finish. I'd love to hear a little bit from your book. Have you got a passage or a couple of passages you'd like to just briefly share with us before we finish today?
I've got two that I would love to share. One explains the pause. So let me start with that.
Please.
When we look at creating and introducing the pause within ourselves and our parenting, we are allowing ourselves, one, to most importantly role model to our teens that there is always a choice in how situations can be dealt with. Two, to make informed choices in emotional situations. Three, to trust ourselves that we can deal with any situation. Four, to create stronger, more consistent relationships with ourselves and our team. Five, to recognize the habits that no longer work for us. Six, to change a way of being. Seven, to heal old ways that have hurt us. Eight, to recognize our feelings and feel them, not react to them. And nine, to take time out to be different, thereby teaching teens you always have the power to transform and create a growth mindset. Life can be the most incredibly powerful learning curve if we let it. It can also be the most relentless pattern of behavior. We can get trapped because the habit is what we have always known, and so we continue generations of behaviors that are ingrained through us as opposed to our chosen authentic behavior. Every day we can learn from all that happens, and in order to do so, we have to make time to reflect and pause so that we have the space to be, to do, and to act differently. The pause is not just a tool for more engaged parenting. It can be a tool that allows us to engage with ourselves and recognize how much of us is a pattern, because we always have done it this way. When we create time to pause, we create space to reflect on how we are who we are, how our choices shape our lives. And then we can choose, after recognizing these elements, to create new patterns and establish new habits that support us in the here and now. This all takes time, but the investment is life-changing for both ourselves and those around us. So our teen is impacted by these choices when we choose to pause. That's that one. And the other one, Colm, is called Emotional Wealth, the Currency to Feel Life. Emotions are the weather in our internal world. To feel allows us to recognize all that is going on within. However, if we are feeling overwhelmed, our thinking isn't too clear, emotions can be the storm in our life, and it can feel like everything is raining down. The feelings of life are impacting on our life, and in turn, this affects thinking and thought patterns. Emotional wealth is to be aware of the power of feelings, to recognize how we are feeling, and to sit with the feelings. It is our job to teach our teens that their feelings add to life, and the more they can embrace, feel, sit with, the more they can allow these feelings to come and go and notice what is going on for and with them. Too many people have been brought up to ignore their feelings or to translate their feelings into thoughts, and then somehow expect these thoughts to deal with the feelings. Imagine for a moment seeing the most beautiful sunset. Your eyes sense the beauty. Your mind appreciates the color and the magic. But no matter how you try to describe it, no words will do it justice. Just as this is the case, so too will no words take away sadness or pain. You will understand the reasons for the sadness, but no thinking will heal the feelings. We then need to support the teen as the most emotional part of their brain is managing their life. Their world is being steered by their feelings, and the teen hasn't been empowered as the gift of their emotions. In order to make life simpler, it is important to teach our teen to check in with themselves. How am I feeling? How is this affecting me? Who can I share this with? What do I need to accept this? Is there anything I can do to feel more at ease in this? Is there anyone I know who can help or support me? How is this impacting my life? Once the teen is made aware of the power of their emotions and can acknowledge that in a bad mood is not the time to start reviewing life, as they will do it in a negative self-talk way, if we educate the teen to know what it is they need to acknowledge their feelings, accept their feelings, not act on their feelings immediately, share their feelings, sit with their feelings, pause and support themselves, we are creating a teen who is able to recognize the power of their emotions, to feel them, to grow through them, and to regulate and stabilize themselves, to allow themselves to grow through difficult times, the challenges of life, to become emotionally resilient, and at the same time, to immerse themselves in the power of the positive feelings. We are giving the teen the ultimate gift, the presence to feel their life every step of the way. They're my two chapters or two parts from my book.
Wow. Okay. Amazing.
Thank you.
On behalf of everybody, excuse me, who's listening today, I just want to say how powerful that is. Emma, thank you for writing that book. It's called Teen Pause. It's going to be available on Amazon from June onwards, correct?
Correct. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. And on behalf of all of the adult teenagers, myself included, who have been listening to this.
Me too.
this podcast, listening to you today, I'm that last reading you just made is as relevant to me nearing 70 years old as it was when I was nearing 17 years old. So there was something there for all of us, whether we're a parent or not, in my opinion. We wish you every blessing in your work. May love continue to empower you in all that you do. And I'm sure that your clients, your teenage clients, realize how fortunate they are to have you in their lives. So thank you for joining me today, Emma. And we look forward to hearing from you again, I hope, in the not too distant future.
Thank you so much for the invite. It has been an amazing experience to talk with you today in the Alchemy Lab. Thank you, Colm.
Bless you. Thank you. Bye.